Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world, a man who brings uncommon intelligence each week to the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal. Is one of its columnists and bright stars, Brett Stevens. He is the author of several books, innumerable commentaries. You see him in all of the right publications and television spots, but we're called to speak with him at this moment because his book, America in Retreat, The New Isolationism and the Coming Global Disorder, has just come out in paperback, and it's a chance to have an opportunity to explore with him what it means that America is retreat and what we should do about it. Brett Stevens, welcome. It's good to have you with us as always.
It's good to be on the show, Frank. Thanks for having me on.
So give us the thesis of the piece, Brett. I mean, some of it's pretty self-evident from the title, of course, but is this a deliberate retreat or is this something that by virtue of inexorable forces of nature is causing us to withdraw somewhat from the world?
No, this is a very deliberate retreat orchestrated by President Obama as part of his policy of shrinking and minimizing America's global footprint to concentrate on what he calls nation building at home. It's really the construction of a European-style social democratic welfare state in the United States. And Obama's calculation was that in order to have that kind of European-style state, he needed a European-style foreign policy, a much smaller military, fewer engagements around the rest of the world, actual physical retreats from places like Iraq and Afghanistan, a clear signal to our allies that they shouldn't count on us to intervene. And the result is very simple. When you create power vacuums around the world, those vacuums get filled, and they get filled by willful, violent men, by Vladimir Putin in Ukraine, by ISIS in northern Iraq and eastern Syria, by the Iranians wherever they can get themselves involved throughout the region, by the Chinese in the South China Sea. So I began writing this book in just before the 2012 election under the title The Coming Global Disorder. We're now living in the current global disorder. So what I can say about this book is that predictively, when the president was telling us that the tide of war was receding, I took a different view, and I think I've been vindicated, unfortunately.
And I hasten to say that I'm sure you take no comfort in being proven right. This is a very bad thing for America and the world. But one thing that I'd like to draw you out on, Brett Stevens, is that in enumerating the effects of this deliberate retreat, you sort of suggested that a practical effect has been creating a vacuum being filled by dangerous men. But is it overreaching to suggest that President Obama seems to prefer those dangerous men filling the void to us and our allies, and that it's actually part of the wrecking operation, as I think of it, that he's emboldening them deliberately?
In a certain sense, you're absolutely right. I mean, he is of the view, and this, I think, goes to the core of his political conviction, that American involvement makes the world worse, that our being there not only costs us in terms of treasure, in terms of blood sometimes, but that wherever America goes, things get worse. So the answer is to retreat. You know, people talk, your initial question was a very canny one, Frank, because there are a lot of people who say, well, America has to retreat because we're in decline. And I spend a lot of time in this book demonstrating that the United States, for all of our problems, is not in decline. We are still by far the most resilient, robust nation in the world. Decline happens for inexorable civilizational reasons. Retreat is a policy choice. Retreat is what Obama wanted. And what we are seeing around the world is a consequence of that retreat. Now, I think Obama didn't imagine just how quickly the forces of disorder would spring up. If you go back just a few years ago, all of the sort of so-called smart people in the foreign policy world were saying that we had this wonderful holiday from history, we could afford to relax. So it's becoming politically a little bit embarrassing for him.
We're speaking with Brett Stevens, the marvelous foreign affairs columnist and deputy editorial page editor of the Wall Street Journal, the author now in paperback of America in Retreat, The New Isolationism and the Coming Global Disorder. Well, the disorder that is upon us, as he says. Brett, you, in your previous incarnation, were the editor-in-chief of another marvelous publication, the Jerusalem Post. And I know you've been very seized, both in that capacity and in your present one, with what we are doing to our friends and our strategic relationship with the Israelis. What should we make of that in particular in the scheme of Obama's agenda here?
Well, I mean, with the Israeli side, I think, is animated by a certain kind of a base level animus that really shows through in everything Obama has done as president from the moment he became president. You know, the insistence that he quote, put daylight between the United States and Israel, the effort to pick very public and often totally unnecessary fights with the Israelis. Fights, by the way, he was not prepared to pick with a Muslim autocrat, anti-Semitic autocrat like Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey. Fights he hasn't been really prepared to pick with a lot of other unsavory leaders around the world. He chose to make an example of the Israelis. But you know what? It goes beyond Israel, because other American allies, noticing what Obama was doing to one of our supposedly closest allies, Israel, started to worry about the strength of their own alliances. So you suddenly had a situation, Frank, where our friends didn't trust us and our enemies didn't fear us. And that combination is a really deadly one, because our enemies then feel emboldened to do as they please, and our friends begin to worry that they're going to have to do as they must. And that's the way the world begins to spin out of control.
Brett, as you look at this, and your crystal ball has proven to be pretty good, do you anticipate that what comes of it, especially with the encouragement to Iranian hegemonism and the reintroduction of Russia into the Middle East and the undermining of our friends there, that we are really watching tee up what often happens when these vacuums are created and the disorder is upon us, and that is war of a very awful kind?
Well, the best analog to the present day is America in the 1920s and 1930s. And now we remember that as a period of isolationism. People have a mistaken idea of isolationism. They imagine it means, a kind of a North Korea-style retreat from the world. Of course, the United States had diplomatic relations, commercial relations, and so on with other countries in those intervening years. But America effectively turned its back on global security when the world desperately needed an economically resilient, confident power to step into the breach and enforce the global order as it had been left in 1918, 1919, in the wake of the First World War. The U.S. refused to do that. What we did is we signed disarmament treaties. We had something called the Kellogg-Briand Pact, outlawing war, a mentality very similar to the progressive liberal mentality of the present. And what happened was the world's rogues in Germany, in the Soviet Union, in Italy, in Japan, all realized that they could take advantage of Western indecision, fecklessness, and a perception or a sense of weakness to remake the world order. And that's how we stumbled into the Second World War. You know, people say the Second World War was our last good war. That's completely false. The Second World War was our last terrible war. Winston Churchill once said it was the unnecessary war because it was so easy to avoid. And yet millions of people were killed because, as in the United States, also in Britain and France, the responsible powers in the world refused to exercise their responsibility against the coming of the dictatorships. And what we had was tragedy.
Brett Stevens, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Congratulations again on the paperback edition of America in Retreat, The New Isolationism and the Coming Global Disorder. Pulitzer Prize winning commentary author Brett Stevens of The Wall Street Journal. Come back to us again, if you will, very soon. Next up, we do a bit of a tag team with my colleague and friend at the Center for Security Policy, Jim Hansen. He'll be talking with Andy McCarthy about Sharia-adherent ideologies and why we have to be concerned about them. That moment.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen, and we're joined this segment by Andy McCarthy. Andy is the author of Willful Blindness and the Grand Jihad, as well as a National Review Online contributing editor. And Andy, I find the words willful blindness, the title of your book, extremely useful. I use them on television and radio a lot, because that seems to be the problem we have. We have a huge issue, both in the United States and I guess in watching our friends in Europe, dealing with a large population of Muslim migrants, and in some cases, Islamist infiltrators among them. And the question becomes what to do with them. Now, we've seen, I think, a great answer for what not to do with them, announced by presidential candidate Donald Trump. And for the United States, that would be registering Muslims in a database based only on the fact that their religion is Islam. Now, I think I read a big dusty old document from well back during, you know, the years of the founding that says you can't do that. So, you know, give us a little insight, at least first, how not to deal with it in the Trumpian way.
Well, you know, the simple fact is that it, number one, would be a violation of the Constitution to single out people for investigation based solely on their affiliation with religion. But second, you know, not to get too much into the constitutional esoterica of it, it would be stupid to do, because I know this is a newsflash to a lot of people, but jihadists lie about what they're doing in order to try to pull it off. And as a result, the only people who would be signing up for a database would be law-abiding Muslims, who are the people who are on our side, who we want on our side, and who would be basically ticked off, I think would be as nice a way as I could put it, at being subjected to that kind of scrutiny. So, you know, that's not what you want to do. I think, Jim, what we really need to do on the social side, let's say, of the civilizational jihad is what we've been trying to do, people like Frank in particular, I through my books, other people on our side, what we've been trying to do for what seems like a generation now, which is simply shine a light on Sharia, which is the sensible dividing line between pro-Western Muslims who don't want to impose Islam's totalitarian classical Sharia law on society, because that law doesn't abide a distinction between civil and political life on the one hand and spiritual life on the other. So you use Sharia to figure out who the radicals are versus who are your allies. And I think the other thing I've always thought we should do is make the people who defend Sharia defend it in the light of day, because I think they'd be a very marginal group in the West if they were forced to defend things like how apostates should be put to death, how gay people should be put to death, how women are basically nothing more than property.
Now, I think we've obviously discarded the idea that a Muslim registry database is a good idea, but you mentioned the distinction between Muslims who believe that Sharia law should be supreme over U.S. law and the rest of the Muslim population. Now, we did at CSP, we did a poll of American Muslims and came up with some shocking and actually horrifying numbers that 51% of them preferred Sharia over the U.S. Constitution, and that 25% were willing to use violence, or at least tolerate violence, if not do violence, in support of that goal. Those are the ones I guess we need to deal with. And you mentioned having them defend that belief in public would be a great way to do, you know, at least show that they're in hopefully a small minority of Americans. How do we do that, though?
Well, I think we have to stop making it taboo to discuss what these people believe. I think a big part of that, Jim, is to correct, and I don't know, this may be too much swimming upstream, but I think we have to correct the misimpression that Islam is a religion, strictly speaking, as we understand religion in the West. And I want to be understood, I'm not saying, because I think this is counterproductive for us to say, that Islam is not a religion, because I think that turns people off when they hear that. But I think, you know, while Islam has tenets that are clearly part of what we would regard as religion in the West, things like the oneness of Allah or the idea that Muhammad is the final prophet of God, for the most part, I would say 85 to 90% of Islamic ideology is not religion as we understand it in the West. It's a political, economic, military ideology that has a few religious tenets. So I think we have to start, for legal purposes, evaluating Islam as a political ideology more than a religion, and understand that if you apply the First Amendment as we apply it in this country to religions that divide political life from spiritual life, what you're going to end up doing is closing your eyes to a lot of things that have nothing to do with religion and have to do with the organization of politics and the economy and military affairs of the state. And obviously that's not something that we can close our eyes to just because Muslims say that it's their religious belief.
Now we've entered the minefield, and you tiptoed in, rightfully so, because I think you make the most important point. Separating the purely religious and, if not non-controversial, at least something we cannot dispute, the pieces of that they want to perform their religion and have the right to do that are indisputable. But there is also the element where some of these tenets of the more societal piece directly conflict with free Western society. And some of those, yeah, as you mentioned, the treatment of women, you know, the idea that a woman's testimony in court is not valuable, the idea that women are property and those things. So separating those out from things such as religious restrictions on diet and you know, how someone practices their religion, do we need legislation to do that? Is that something that should happen in the courts? How are we going to work that out? Because they're immediately going to throw the First Amendment flag and say you can't touch that.
Jim, first of all, the First Amendment is a restriction on government, right? It doesn't restrict us. We can have this conversation. We're not the government. And it would have been shocking to the framers to think that because people had First Amendment liberty, meaning that you can believe whatever you want to believe in this country. If you want to believe that the moon is made out of blue cheese, you can believe that. But that doesn't mean we're not allowed to examine your beliefs and say they're absurd when they're absurd, right? So, you know, I think here's the easy way, or the easiest way I can think of to convey this idea. If you think that you should pray five times a day, nobody in America is going to have a problem with that whatsoever. But if you deny the core tenet that the United States is based on, that is to say that the people have a right to govern themselves according to their own choices and forge their own destiny, if you believe instead that the people must obey an antecedent religious code that is deemed to be the immutable word of Allah and that is not capable of being changed or amended in any way that the people see fit in order to chart their own destiny, then that's a big problem. And that's not a religious problem. That goes to the heart of what kind of a body politic we are.
Well, Andy, I think you, as I mentioned, you led us into the minefield, and I think you gave us at least a marker on the other side. I think we're going to have some work to do separating those things, but starting the conversation is the first piece of that, and that's what we're doing right now. As they say, though, the devil is in the details. Thank you very much. We will be back, and Frank Gaffney will be back after the break. This is Jim Hansen. We're doing Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, 16 members of Congress who have served our country in uniform wrote the Joint Chiefs of Staff respectfully warning the military leadership against executing any order from the Commander-in-Chief to bring jihadists currently held at Guantanamo Bay into the United States. In a letter organized by Representative Mike Pompeo of Kansas, the signatories noted that overwhelming bipartisan majorities have repeatedly prohibited any such transfer. Indeed, even Mr. Obama's Attorney General Loretta Lynch testified last week that, quote, the law does not allow, unquote, bringing Gitmo detainees here. That would make any direction from Obama to do it an unlawful order, and military personnel are required by the Uniform Code of Military Justice to disobey such orders. Our thanks go out to those in Congress who once had that duty and who have now afforded their still-serving comrades the political cover to do theirs. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by our duty expert on Asia. He is that of Fox News and Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com. He is also a best-selling author, notably of The Coming Collapse of China. He is Gordon Chang, of course. We visit with him each week, and it's always a pleasure to do so. Welcome back, Gordon. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, speaking of welcome back, President Obama has returned from his most recent forays overseas, which included several stops in Asia. What did you make, if anything, of his travels there? Is this the long-awaited pivot, or was it not much about not much?
Well, President Obama opposed the Chinese rhetorically. The Chinese opposed Obama rhetorically, and nothing really happened. I think the real issue, though, is what's going on below the civilian-to-civilian context. What we're having is the PACOM commander, Admiral Harry Harris, has actually started to work quite effectively, I think, in countering Chinese moves. But this is really going to be military to military. I don't think the president is contributing very much in this at this point.
With respect to specifically, I guess, Gordon, the place of greatest contention at the moment in Harry Harris's area of operations is the South China Sea. Give us an update, if you would, on what's happening there. I gather that the Chinese are now beginning to bring some advanced fighter aircraft to some of their man-made islands. It's a little unclear how long they can maintain them there, but because of the corrosion of the sea air and so on. But for the moment, how significant do you think this looks in terms of a challenge to freedom of navigation and to the claims to that territory by others, including a number of our allies. And then talk a little bit about Japan and some recent comments by the Prime Minister concerning that area.
The Chinese are now basing their advanced J-11 fighters on Woody Islands in the Paracel Islands, which are a little bit north of the reclamations in the Spratlys. Those are essentially Russian Su-27s, so they're a very important and very capable aircraft. And, of course, they're going to threaten freedom of navigation, both in the air and on the sea, in the South China Sea. At the same time, as you point out, the Japanese are now talking about patrols in the South China Sea. And just a few hours ago, we had the Chinese say that they are extremely concerned. They're going to put their forces on high alert if the Japanese enter the South China Sea. So what we're having now is an internationalization of the issues. And this is going to continue, especially as the Japanese and the Indians and Australians become much more involved in that body of water. This is going to be China against the rest of the world. And it's probably not going to be very pretty for Beijing.
Do you think, Gordon, and we talk about this with some regularity here, that we could find miscalculations leading to an actual shooting war in connection with what's going on in the South China Sea at the moment and the internationalization, as you say, of this potential crisis, I guess?
Yeah, there is a high possibility of miscalculation. And I think it's largely because the Chinese are very arrogant these days. And so they think that they can push other countries around by merely doing what they want. They are going to go much too far. This has sort of been the history of aggressors. And so that is why people are concerned about what's happening not only in the South China Sea, but of course the East China Sea and the Yellow Seas. They don't get as much attention as events down south because there aren't reclamations in the Yellow Sea and the East China Sea. But there are also potential sources of conflict between Japan and China, as well as South Korea and China. And so this is going to continue across China's periphery from the south to the north.
Speaking of the Koreans, I gather that there's now a new effort underway to try to begin the dialogue between the two nations on the peninsula. Do you expect anything to come of that, Gordon?
Yeah, South Korea has asked North Korea to engage in working-level talks. And a couple days ago, the North Koreans agreed. At the same time, South Korea is sending its chief nuclear negotiator to Beijing. And this is an attempt to revive the six-party talks. I don't think anything will come of this, largely because the North Koreans are not at this point willing to engage with the international community in good faith. Very rarely are they willing to do so, especially not now. We have more indications of turmoil at the top of the North Korean regime with a very senior figure not showing up at a state funeral. This, by the way, is a vice marshal or someone who was a vice marshal before he was demoted. So again, it's more problems between Kim Jong-un, the ruler, and the military, which is the most powerful institution in North Korean society. So this is not bound to be, this is bound not to be good. And so, therefore, I don't think anything will come of discussions between North Korea and anybody, not between North Korea and China, its ally, and certainly not between North Korea and anybody else.
You know, Gordon, the observation about who appeared at a state funeral and who didn't reminds me, of course, of the effort by Kremlinologists during the Cold War to ascertain what the state of, you know, the hierarchy within the old Soviet Union was by virtue of who was standing and standing where on Lenin's tomb as the parades went by. I guess this is what we're reduced to in terms of understanding what's afoot inside the hermit kingdom of North Korea.
Absolutely. You know, if you look at, for instance, what I was referring to, the apparent disappearance of Cho Rong-hae, who was once considered and a number of times considered to be the number two official in North Korea, this is absolutely significant that he didn't appear. And also, more important, his name did not appear on the organizing committee for the state funeral. This is much more important about than who was standing next to who in the Kremlin, because that was temporary. With the disappearance of Cho, this could very well be more than just a temporary disappearance for health. So clearly something's afoot. We don't know exactly what it is, but it really means that there is continued instability at the top of the ruling group. And that is never good news for anybody.
Yeah. We're speaking with Gordon Chang, a regular commentator and contributor on matters involving Asia. Gordon, there has been considerable ferment, of course, in China. You've been talking about this with us for several years now. The economic situation continues, it seems, to be darkening. The largest bond default ever, the subject of a column by you last week. There is, of course, also evidence of the continuing hemorrhage of money. I guess the Chinese have tumbled upon a $64 billion underground bank that has been moving money abroad. Talk about that, if you would, a little bit, and also the evidence that in Hong Kong, people are becoming increasingly assertive. Will that amount to anything in terms of reestablishing a measure of independence or at least autonomy there?
With regard to the Chinese economy, there have been a couple of pieces of important news in the last weeks. One of them is the largest bond default, which you referred to, which is a cement company. And although we can maybe have a remedy of the default, I don't think that that's actually going to occur in this case. And we could see a number of bond defaults because essentially the government doesn't have the ability or the willingness now to support all the players and all the bond issuers. The big issue here is one of money, and it appears almost certainly that China has been misreporting its foreign exchange reserves by overstating them. This is something that countries do when they're in real trouble, which is an indication that I think that China is pretty much on the edge. With regard to Hong Kong, we have all sorts of really unhappy news for the people in Hong Kong. The Justice Minister just announced that when a new rail link is established, that Chinese law enforcement officers are going to be patrolling the southern terminus of the rail link, which means they're going to be in Hong Kong. This is really concerning, largely because, you know, the Chinese law enforcement agents and security agents have unofficially been coming into Hong Kong and grabbing people and doing all sorts of things unmolested. But now it's becoming official that their security personnel will be enforcing laws in Hong Kong. And so this is obviously another erosion of the one country, two systems concept.
Yeah, it sure is. Gordon, we have to leave it to that for the moment. Thank you so much for your time today, as always. And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Have a good Thanksgiving holiday in the interval. And we're thankful for your constant updates on these very important developments. Keep it up, my friend. Godspeed.
Next up, Stephen Coughlin, one of our country's preeminent authorities on the jihadist operating system of Sharia, talks about how it might be turning up in a theater near you at 0 hour. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Our guest, I'm very pleased to say, is a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy, a man who is the driving force behind a new consulting operation called Unconstrained Analytics. He is the author of several important books, including Catastrophic Failure, Blindfolding America in the Face of Jihad, and a new monograph as part of the Center's Civilization Jihad Reader Series, Bridge Building to Nowhere, the Catholic Church's Case Study of the Interfaith Delusion. He is, of course, Stephen Coughlin, an attorney by training, a man who served as the duty expert on jihad and Sharia for the Joint Chiefs of Staff until he was, well, purged from the Pentagon. Steve Coughlin, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
You have been doing extraordinarily important analysis and warnings, really, over a long period of time about the nature of the enemy we face and the intentions it has to force us all to submit
to its, well, I think of it as their operating system, Sharia. That threat level of alarm has risen considerably, as I understand it. Talk about why.
Well, I think there are two timelines that we can get from the Islamic world that tell us that things are converging this month in, or this upcoming month in December. And what I mean is at the end of this year and the beginning of next year. The first one is the one that was established by the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, the OIC, when in December 2005 they met and came up with something called the 10-Year Program of Action to make defamation of Islam a crime in every jurisdiction. Now, it's really important to understand that the OIC actually has state actor presence, such that President Bush created a special envoy to him, that when President Obama became president, he stepped up that role, and I think Rashad Hussein was appointed as America's representative to the OIC. Now, that tells you that as a state actor, it has some presence. Now, the 10-year program of action to make defamation of Islam a crime in every jurisdiction is supposed to work itself through the UN and other international organs and appear facially neutral in the language. So when you read it, it's not apparent what it's doing. Now, what's important about that is that it manifests itself in UN Resolution 1618. And in July 2011, the Secretary of State of the United States of America went to a foreign country, Turkey, to meet with the head of the OIC, a man named Ekmelettin İnanoğlu, to offer the OIC America's best efforts to help pass UN Resolution 1618. Now, this is a staggering affront to the First Amendment of the Constitution. So what we have is this timeline, this OIC timeline. Now, go back to the beginning of this year. The first thing that happened, the first week of January, they assassinated the people at Charlie Hebdo. Then weeks later, they tried to kill the people at Yilan's Posten, who actually published the cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. And then, of course, we had what happened to Pam Geller in Texas. Now, it was in February that I told people, because this is the 10th year of the 10-year program of action, that we should expect to see a stepped up levels of terrorism at the end of the year. So I think that what we saw in Paris is completely predictable. I think that what we can expect to see this manifest itself throughout the West through the end of the year. The second timeline, I think, comes at it from the other angle. Now I want to talk about the timeline that comes from Al-Qaeda and ISIS. We had Rashad Hussein, who was in prison with a man named Zarqawi in 2002, who ran the Zarqawi Network, also called at the time Al-Qaeda in Iraq, that then became known as ISIL, that we call the Islamic State today. And when he was in there, he interviewed him, and he came up with what were called the Al-Qaeda timelines. They said in 2010 they would establish the fall of the Arab regimes to establish Islamic states there, and that's when the Arab Spring started. The effort to bring them down started in 2010, and we saw the Arab Spring start in February 2011. They called for the standing up of ISIS in the year 2013. 2014 timeframe, and the declaration of the caliphate. And you had in June 2014, ISIS declared itself the Islamic State, and they declared themselves the caliphate. In 2016 is the year where they're declaring all-out confrontation. And I think it's really important to understand that for all those people who you were suggesting just a second ago, who talk about ISIS being defeated, Al-Qaeda being grounded down, so they're right where they said they would be. And that tells you they're nothing. They are not the incoherent players that our people say they are. They are exactly where they said they would be, and that means we should be anticipating overt confrontation, meaning outright war starting in 2016. And I tell you, I think we need to position our understanding of these refugees who are overwhelmingly draft age men in that kind of consideration.
In Europe in particular, Steve Coughlin is our guest with Unconstrained Analytics, also a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy and the author of Catastrophic Failure and Bridge Building to Nowhere. Check them out, folks. Steve, on that question of all-out war, we're told by François Hollande, by President Obama, and I guess others, that we're at war right now with the Islamic State. Do you contemplate, when you talk about this, something rather different?
I can't understand how they could say they're at all-out war and then have like 8 strikes in a day. against targets that don't really convert into anything that's meaningful. I'm very skeptical. I mean, the level of effort does not match the statements that are being made. What they do match is the ability to have photo ops and press releases that say they struck something without actually having to bear the consequences of doing really practically nothing.
But Steve, you've seriously gone to school on these guys. The what's going on with respect to their psychology or pathologies, if you will, their ideology. What does it mean in their Sharia operating system when they see the West, the infidels, seemingly acting without resolution is the most charitable way to describe it, and submitting, I'm afraid, is a more accurate depiction, at least as seen by them?
Well, I think on two levels you can answer that question, and they're both bad, and they both feed into the point you're making. One is I think our level of effort allows them to project themselves as fighting the infidel in a way that they still stand in the battlefield at the end of the day. Two, I think that level of effort doesn't imply a lack of will. I think it is a lack of will. And I think that I don't think they're sensing this. I think that they're seeing it. And I think that is a reflection of the reality of the situation that they have properly assessed.
But is it fair to say that according to their doctrine, they are actually supposed to redouble their efforts when they see us submitting? And that really goes to your point about war. So what kind of war are you forecasting? You've used the term elsewhere, zero hour. And could that mean an all-out war in our own country, not just the Middle East or perhaps Europe?
Well, you know, in Afghanistan, we've heard the use of the word the perfect day that relates to the sepoy, that points to the sepoy rebellion with the British in the 19th century. And we hear from Al-Qaeda and ISIS and even from the Brotherhood this concept of zero hour. And it really points to the fact that there's an event-driven timeline. We just talked about the one from Al-Qaeda. All-out confrontation in 2016, that they are focusing on a timeline to a certain specific date where they're going to do these things. So I think we can expect to see terrorism in this country of a kind with what we saw in Paris. Clearly, they're saying they're going to do it. And I think everybody recognizes there's a capacity to make that happen. So even if it doesn't happen, it's not inappropriate to have warning because there are indicators that they are going to make that attempt.
And Steve, we have to leave it at this, I'm afraid. But, you know, look no further than what they've done in Belgium over the past several days with really nothing more than the threat of violence to shut the country down and create conditions of a national state of emergency. Steve Coughlin, thank you very much, as always, for the incredible work you have done, both in uniform, major in the United States Army Reserves, retired now, with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and, of course, with us at the Center for Security Policy. Keep it up. Come back to us again very soon. My colleague Jim Hansen talks Argentina, the election there, with Ambassador Roger Noriega right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where a relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen, joined this segment by Ambassador Roger Noriega, who is a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, as well as former U.S. Ambassador to the Organization of American States and a former Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs. Sir, what I wanted to discuss was the potential that ISIS may not just be a threat as part of the Syrian refugee flow or a threat of normal infiltration, but potentially may have the opportunity to take advantage of our, well, almost non-secured southern border and join the migrant flow through the states that are connected to the United States to the south. I'd like your thoughts as to the potential for them to infiltrate via that route, difficulties, and how that could potentially play out as a threat.
Well, the well-informed folks in your audience will know that narco-traffickers and terrorists use the same routes that, as a matter of fact, control the same routes that are used to smuggle aliens illegally across our border. And we've already, in recent weeks, detected Syrian nationals with fake passports from various different countries trying to move across our border and moving across various borders within the hemisphere without any problem. And these folks are just one step away from entering the United States. In most of these cases, they're going to be illegal aliens with innocent intentions, if you pardon the expression, but and not terrorists. But these routes show a vulnerability for terrorists to use to enter the United States.
Now, is there I think obviously there's a fair amount of degree of difficulty. You're still crossing international borders. You're still dealing with passports forged or otherwise. So is there a way we could simply step up the procedures in place with an eye towards this? I mean, I hate to use that horrifying word of profiling, but if you've got people coming from particular areas with a particular threat, is there a way to do that? Do any of these countries employ techniques like that that we could use, you know, potentially to our advantage?
Well, we have to tighten things up with all of our neighbors, and there have been numerous cases of folks in the region detecting people who can't even speak Spanish carrying Venezuelan passports. I would say that's our biggest vulnerability, because that's a regime that wants to do us harm, made common cause with Iran to carry that asymmetrical struggle to our doorstep. And this is not, these are not suppositions. These are statements of the Iranians and the Venezuelans to carry that asymmetrical struggle to the U.S.'s neighborhood. So we need to tighten up our relations with these folks. Clearly, Canada and Mexico are the biggest vulnerabilities because of that land border. And we have close relationships with them, but we certainly need to, all along this chain in our hemisphere, ensure that countries are paying attention to these things. For example, within Mercosur in South America, you can move across the border without a passport. And that's precisely how some of these people on phony passports that they obtained in Brazil were able to move across into Argentina undetected. We've got to tighten those sorts of things up.
Well, it seems like we've at least got a similar problem to the zone of passport-free travel the Europeans are potentially ruining their support for. Let me ask you a question now about some of the elections recently that happened nearby. Argentina has a new president, and it was a bit of a surprise, I guess, that the ruling leftist party has been ousted. And I don't know how much of a capitalist this guy is, but can you tell us a little bit about the new president for Argentina?
Mauricio Macri was the successful mayor of Buenos Aires. And really stunned the Peronist movement that has held power there for decades. And in recent years, a strain of Peronism, very anti-American, very divisive, making friendships with Iran and Venezuela and countries that mean us harm. Macri is an unapologetic free market guy. And has already declared his intention to throw Venezuela out of the common market of the South, Mercosur, on human rights and democracy grounds. So this is a 180-degree change in orientation. I think it will show us a momentum in the region in favor of the rule of law, democracy, and even free market policies that open up the economy and make it more competitive to create jobs through private sector growth. So it's a remarkable change.
And I mean, is that the driving force? Was it economics? Was it the failure of the socialist dream, as it always seems to do, to deliver any kind of prosperity to the people? And at this point, they want someone who actually understands how economics works?
Right, absolutely. I think that's a big part of it. There's also, a rejection of the kind of rancorous and polarizing tactics of the previous government, using the power of the state to menace its opponents and silence freedom of expression and independent media. So it's a rejection of that, but it's basically economic and a question of individual security, personal security, that probably made the difference here. And an expectation that with some tweaks in economic policy, they can start to create jobs there, get Argentina back among countries that respect human rights, democracy, and for that matter, paying their bills and their international debt.
Which everybody seems to think is a good idea. Does this bode well for the possibility of rapprochement or any better relations for us with Argentina? Obviously, we were not getting along well with the previous government.
Right, I think it does. Macri is very open to the United States. I've had contact with his folks for years. He is sees a role for Argentina in the region in defense of democracy, and he sees the upside of positive relations with the United States. So it's a really important difference.
Well, now let's jump to another country that we have at least some distinct interest in. Guatemala has elected a comedian president. And not that I think we're in much of a position as the United States to say we're much better off, but that's somewhat entertaining. What's the backstory there?
Yeah, I mean, at least when this president, the president of Guatemala, now makes jokes, he's doing it on purpose, as opposed to ours, who does it subconsciously. He was an independent. Is an independent. We're talking about elections held after the previous president and vice president were ousted, had to resign under pressure because of corruption charges. So hopefully, we can look at the region and say that the people are clamoring for accountable government, for fighting corruption, against cronyism, states that are accountable to their people, in management of state resources as well as keeping them secure and looking for ways to start economic growth. And that's really critical for us. You need the rule of law and economic growth to keep this illegal immigrant wave under control. The Obama administration would like us all to think that from that border crisis of 2 years ago, 2 summers ago, that it's much improved. In point of fact, it's not true. The Mexicans are just catching the Central Americans before they make it to our southwest border. But the outflow of folks from Central America has not really subsided. And it can become a problem again at our border at any time.
I hate to have a positive attitude, but those two presidential elections in our hemisphere seem to at least be a step in the right direction. We appreciate your insights, Ambassador Roger Noriega, and we will hope our neighbors keep a good eye on any infiltrating ISIS-affiliated folks. That's going to wrap up Secure Freedom Radio for today. Frank Gaffney will be back tomorrow helping you out with information about the war for the free world.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.